Today's episode with Susie Lee, who's an artist, entrepreneur, and educator, is about moving through shifting and changing identities. Cultural, personal, and professional shifts in identity happen for all of us. Susie shares the insights she's gained as a child of immigrants, through career changes, and now as a parent. She shares this life journey and the many ways that she's learned to problem solve for different ways of being. From taking a career leap away from the expectations of her parents to becoming a mother for the first time in her mid-40s, Susie highlights the importance of flexibility, curiosity, and choice, especially in the narrative surrounding pregnancy, childbirth, and parenting. I particularly love the way that she views life as an experiment, by looking at each stage of life as it is, knowing that the next stage is never certain. And this kind of view is something that I use as a Buddhist and can help any of us with the major changes life throws at us, whatever they may be. Content notification: this is an authentic conversation where we discuss the importance of choice and access in any person's experience and touch on things like miscarriage and social ideas of normal or natural pregnancy. I also want to acknowledge that not all folks who have babies identify as women. And now on to my conversation with Susie. Good morning, Susie. Thanks so much for making time to be on Everything is Workable.
Good morning. Thank you for the invite.
This is super fantastic. I guess to give listeners context, we met while I was doing feminist camp. I really appreciated you coming out and talking. It was great to meet so many interesting people. And I'm really glad that we get to connect to collaborate on an episode of the podcast now.
I've loved feminist boot camp since it started, and I think this was my third year doing it. The opportunity to meet, you know, anywhere from 5 to 12 amazing, thoughtful, progressive individuals has always been an obvious yes for me. So I'm glad I get to meet you there.
That's so cool. That's fantastic. Thank you. So my first question that I always ask guests, just to kind of set the stage, is a bit about their personal background and the point at which they became aware of the need for like social restorative work, or like awareness of that. I always frame it in when you moved from I am suffering to there is suffering, and what that experience was like for you.
Oh, that's interesting. I think there were probably a few moments of that, but having it kind of really become an integral part of my identity, I think, came a little bit later. As the first daughter of immigrants, Korean immigrants, I think actually it's part of our history and narrative to say there is suffering. I grew up with stories of, you know, my parents talking about the Korean War and the country being split, which is interesting because of the talks that are happening now, and how they were brought up, which of course is, it sounds surreal, right? To think of your parents who are seemingly these very normal people living in a condition in which, you know, my father would say we would see body parts in the gutter. So I think I was always somewhat aware of that at the time. Of course, it wasn't like they were like, we want you to suffer now. In fact, it was the exact opposite. We also grew up in a time that there wasn't a lot of understanding and language around identity politics, but I think almost every immigrant, second generation child has experienced their parents saying something like, we live in the U.S., there's, you know, this idea of an American dream, but you will have to work twice as hard in order to get half as much. And you don't quite understand what that means, but it's kind of been instilled in you. So it's interesting because it's not like they said, well, you know, you are the other, you are the outsider, you are not white. Like, none of that was actually said directly. It was just this idea that, you know, you didn't quite fit in. So in order to get what this country could potentially offer, you had to do a lot more work. So, you know, that's something that I grew up with. And when I went to college, they had something that was actually for minorities at Yale. And it was strange because I think I went for this very practical reason that I just wanted to go to school a little bit early and get a sense of what it was like. So they had a program, and I think it's probably different now. I remember that was the first time that the speakers there would talk about it's us against them, which was interesting because I had grown up in North Dakota for the last 10 years. And so I would say 100% of my friends and social life was actually white Midwestern North Dakotans. Mm-hmm. So I actually found it quite alienating because I was kind of like, I don't know who the us is and who the others are. And I think it was at that time that I also had much more of a deeper exploration of identity and what that meant, not only racially, but what the trajectory that I wanted was. And I think there was this idea that I would go to Yale and then I would go to med school and then I would become a doctor and then I would marry a lawyer and everything was going to be amazing and great for my parents. And it was actually at that time that I realized I just had a very strong sense that I didn't want to do that. And I couldn't really point out why, except I would say things like, I'm so tired of being in the ivory tower and I just want to do something that feels real. And I would throw out things like, I want to take a year off school and join an organization that would, you know, help abroad. And I'd never done anything like that before. So I think it really shocked my parents too. Like they were like, who is this individual? And I don't even think you can look at like the, you know, the soup that college is and say, well, it's because of these clear reasons that she felt a need to do this and that. But because of all of that, and because my parents were also like, no, you need to finish your education. I didn't do very well at school because I was like, okay, I'm miserable. I'm going to show the world how miserable I am by shooting myself in the foot. But afterwards, I said, you know, I'm not going to go to medical school. I'm actually going to start teaching. And at first they were like, oh, great. That's not a problem. You can teach college. That's great. And I was like, no, actually, I'm going to teach high school. I'm going to teach in a public school. And this is actually going to be an all Black and Hispanic public school. So they were very worried. And I think that they thought that I was just freaking out and kind of experiencing a rebellion of some sort. And, you know, this is all things that they weren't telling me. I'm sure this was, you know, late night conversations that parents have going like, what's wrong with our kid? What did we do wrong? You know, at the time, it's like, you don't know, right? Like, it could be like a freak out or a phase. But I felt for the first time like I was doing something that felt really right and really meaningful. And even though it was incredibly difficult and I actually felt like I was failing a lot, somehow it was something that it wasn't like when I was failing, I thought, oh, no, I need to go back to med school. It was really like, what else is there that I should be doing? So I think that was kind of the start of all of the kinds of endeavors that I'm looking at doing and of the variables in my life, how to piece them together to create a more cohesive individual that says, of the talents and privileges that I've been given, where are the places that I can make an impact, not only as an individual, but within an organization or a system?
Right. Yeah. So that identity piece, there's the identity that we get from our parents, mm-hmm. and then the overarching cultural identity, which for anybody who is a child of immigrants, you've got two different cultures. For sure.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, it's not even, you know, some parents are very clear about saying we want to preserve our culture from, a country that we probably haven't been to in a while. And, you know, you have to remember, like in the 60s, 70s and 80s, international travel wasn't considered common. And because of my parents' financial situation, they left Korea in the late 60s and didn't return for 20 years. So, you know, even as a young child, like I could understand how incredibly difficult and what a sacrifice. I mean, it's definitely, that's the word that they would use, right? It's a sacrifice to do that, you know, but at the same time, and I think it applies more to then than it is now. There was a lot of studies that nostalgia is very powerful mm-hmm. because they're bringing over a country that actually has changed in the last 20 years that they don't remember. So they're holding on to this idea of a Korea from 1965. And that when we finally went back in the mid-1980s, like I could actually sense their confusion that they were like, wow, you know, like Korea had started to modernize. And so they were, of course, really proud of that. But they were also like, we don't remember any of this. So even for them, there's a duality too.
Yeah, that shift in identity, which is a fantastic segue. So you have a very strong and adorable child.
Oh, thank you.
That's a perfect compliment for any parent.
I'm always amazed at how strong babies are. I'm like, wow, you like your entire purpose is about growing.
Yes. And they are very, they're very good at doing that in giant leaps.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a big change for anybody becoming a parent. It's massive. And, for you in particular, your story and trajectory. So I don't know if you could just give sort of like a hop, skip and a jump of like your career life, working life, things that you did up to the point of you're going to have a child.
Yeah, it was a little, not a very typical trajectory. And I'm 45 now. So it's very funny to have a young baby in the second half of your life as opposed to the first half. So after college, I went to graduate school for education. I did become a teacher in the public school system. There were a lot of things broken in the system. So I considered either going into higher ed and, you know, becoming like an administrator, but was really frustrated with the pace that education reform could happen. So I kind of did a complete deep dive, felt like my identity was like a vase and I smashed it, looked at the pieces again and turned and actually became an artist. So went to graduate school for an MFA. Was drawn to sculpture and ceramics. So that's kind of the medium that I started with. But it was strange. It was like I got out of school and it was like the universe was like, yeah, we're cool with this. We can do this. And so I had a gallery and I began showing and doing all the things that I think artists wish that they could do. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. But at some point, I also recognized that same calling of like, all right, what are you doing that's making an impact in the world? And the art world was increasingly becoming very elite, really focusing on art fairs and collectors and less about the kinds of statements that they wanted to make in the world, and particularly the impacts that they wanted to have. And I think that when you look at the history of art, there are absolutely many, many times that even though history tends to soften these impacts, that artists have always asked what's outside of the elite and the rich. So went back, looked at the things that I was able to do. I merged technology and sculpture together and decided to create a dating app. And suddenly I was an entrepreneur with an artist background. And ran a feminist dating app for 4 years. And then that closed. Then I got to the point where I was like, okay, what's next? And had never really thought about kids as part of that narrative. And interestingly enough, my parents actually are great. You know, for all the leaps that I've made, they've always been one step behind, but they managed to always keep up. And I think that in the spectrum of parents, and particularly Asian and immigrant parents, they're actually quite open-minded in their thinking. And so each time I sort of made another like left turn, they're like, oh my God, I could feel them being like, she's becoming increasingly crazier. But they would always somehow have this faith that I would be okay and figure out my way. And I think they also really realized I sounded happier each time there was more chaos in my life. Mm-hmm. And so even though they're like, that's not the thing that they would want to choose, they kept up. So that was great. So anyways, I got to the point where the startup had closed. It had been a really hard but challenging and rewarding 4 years. And so I was pretty sad. A good art mentor and professor of mine had passed away also recently, and someone that I had been very, very close with for, you know, almost 17 years. So when I wasn't feeling good, it made sense to me that I just physically wasn't feeling well. But after like 3 weeks, like I tended to be, especially after like all these kind of new challenges in my life, like someone who would start to bounce back. So when I wasn't bouncing back, I was like, okay, something's wrong with me. So then I thought it was maybe an ulcer. And then when digestive enzymes and antacids didn't seem to fix it, I was like, oh my God, maybe it's cancer. So then I finally went to the doctor. They did a bunch of tests. Everything came back negative. Then at the end, they said, we should do a pregnancy test to rule it out. And I said, no, don't be silly. We don't need to do that. It's not about that side of my organs. It's like my stomach and intestines. They're like, well, it's easy to do. Let's do it anyways. It came back positive. And I said, you should do that test over again. And they came back with two positive tests.
So, and you're 44 at this point, right?
I'm 44, and I've actually already taken a fertility diagnostic test at 40. Not because I actually wanted to have kids, but because I wanted to get off hormonal birth control, which I felt after 20 years was probably not great for my system, that there was an increased risk of blood clots and, you know, other things. So I just wanted a snapshot before thinking of other options. And at the time, at 40, they said, oh, there's a less than 1% chance of you conceiving, which, you know, when I told people that I was pregnant, people were like, see, it's not zero. You're so silly. How could you have not thought that that's possible? But of course, you know, another way of thinking about it is less than 1% is also the rate of IUDs failing. So it was like having nature's birth control. So I was like, yeah, we're good. And it's not like fertility goes up every year. So yeah, it was quite the shock.
Indeed. So the unpredictability of, like, yeah, you can plan, you can go and get that test that says 1% or less than 1%. You can use any kind of birth control where actually it is usually, yeah, it's like, this is 99.9% protective. Yes.
Right. You hear many stories of people that are like, we did that plus a condom. God knows what happened. You know, it's like that. It's just, yeah.
Yeah. So what was your experience in that moment of finding out that you were pregnant?
I actually just started laughing because it was just absurd. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to rationalize every reason why that could possibly be positive that wasn't actually pregnancy. And so I thought, oh, no, it must have been one of those like early miscarriages. And that's why the hormones are in my system. I have a science background, so I have no idea like why I was trying to figure out other reasons why those hormones could possibly be in my system. But I think that at the time, of course, I was 44. There was enough like surprises that you had to roll with that I just thought, okay, you know what? Like, I'm sure there's another reason for this. So let's just figure out what's going on. Mm-hmm. So I actually didn't really believe it until the next day when they did an ultrasound to just confirm whether or not there was an actual viable pregnancy. And so, you know, in the theme of like, this is workable, I think that one of the things that is really important to talk about is this idea of choice. I can say from really like a very, very personal experience that having a choice was so fundamental, not only to the ultimate decision, but during the whole process of having the ultrasound. And I felt at some level that I wasn't given the choices that another friend of mine who'd gone through Planned Parenthood did, that they pointed the screen at me and just told me what was going on. And there was no like ill will towards me about why that was. It was just that going in a hospital setting and everyone assuming that in my mid-40s I had been trying for a child, that there was just one narrative that would make sense, which is that this person 100% wanted to have kids. I think that in Planned Parenthood, they are much more aware that there's a spectrum of choices that women want to make and that they don't necessarily even know what choice they want to make at that moment. So my friend's experience was that at every chance that there was an option, whether to see the screen or not, whether he wanted the ultrasound technician to share something, they asked what she wanted to do. And so it was a very different kind of experience. And I remember feeling like, I remember actually sitting like on the table and feeling like, oh, you're doing this. And, you know, it wasn't like I was like, hey, can you not tell me to do something? And you know, people on the outside can look at an experience and go, well, why didn't you just say X, right? And it's never that easy. Even though you know you should feel you should have a choice, there's nothing in that room that's actually offering it to you. So you just have to kind of go with the flow. And I remember the feeling when the ultrasound technician said, there it is, and it's 9 weeks old, and there's the heartbeat. And you sort of learn a little bit of basics about reproduction, but people forget that these things are detectable as early as 6 or 7 weeks. And I felt like you know, if I really at the time was like, nope, I do not want to have a child. I don't think it's right for me at this time or in my state of mind. I would have wanted to make the decision without someone pushing me to say, but there's a heartbeat. This is viable. This is a potential human being. And not because I feel like you shouldn't know that information, but a heartbeat of a small thing that looks the size of a bean is a very different thing than thinking about a heartbeat of an infant. Those are different. There's a heartbeat, but there's no actual real organ that's fully developed. So it just colors it in a very, very different way. So I remember being completely shocked and going like, what? I don't understand. Like, this is someone else's life. And everybody going, oh my God, congratulations. This is great. And really feeling like I can't meet you there. Like, I don't know how to do that at this moment. And so finally one of the doctors was like, congratulations, maybe? Like, and I was like, let's just call it fascinating right now. So, and that's kind of where I was at.
All right. So you decided to carry on. You decided to have the child. And what was that process like? Why was it that you, like, because even if in that moment there was just one narrative that you must be happy in, that later on when you can get out of that space, and I totally get that when you're in certain spaces that have been constructed in a way that it assumes like, oh, you are a woman getting an ultrasound in hospital, you must want to be pregnant.
Yes.
So you're like, oh, you have a really limited view. But once you're outside of that, then you can like process a little more and realize, okay, I do have some choices. So what was that shift like for you?
Well, you know, you actually said a really interesting phrase, which is like, you decided to have the child.
I know, I was working on that. I was like, how do I ask this question?
Yeah, and it's an interesting thing because that actually wasn't the phrase that I ever used, because I had known many friends who had miscarriages before, and because of my age and everyone said that there was a very high risk of that or other reasons, that what I had decided on was like, I would go through with a pregnancy for as long as the journey would take me. So I remember that I wasn't like, we're going to have a child, because that result was not necessarily the one that we could guarantee or promise. And so I think because of that, what it really was I would embrace the process no matter what happened. And part of that reason that I needed to do that was because one way or the other, if I was really trying to go for a particular end goal and it wasn't achieved, that it would be really devastating. And so for me, I'm like, you know, pregnancy is like, I mean, it's really gestation. And as an artist, you know what the gestation of an idea is like. As an entrepreneur, you know what the gestation of a company is like. And it never turns out the way that you really think it's going to. And so being in this kind of hovering state was really the best state of mind for me to be in. And to just say like, okay, like every time we go in, we'll see what's going on. And it was kind of funny because the day after the ultrasound, I was like, oh my God, I have an entity inside, right? the next day I actually ended up bleeding really heavily. So I thought, oh my God, now I'm having a miscarriage. Like, what is the universe telling me at this point? It's like, we want to treat you like a pinball machine. So I talked with a friend and was like, oh my God, like, what am I supposed to do at this point? And she was very grounded and rational. And she said, well, Susie, if you are having a miscarriage, there's nothing you can do. Like, there's no position you can be in. There's nothing you can do to stop it. And I was like, I don't even know if I want to stop this. but she was like, but if it's okay, then it's okay. So I asked the doctor and I just said, I don't know. And it was like a super calm. It was weirdly calm. I was like, I think I'm bleeding really heavily and I might be having a miscarriage. What am I supposed to do? And they said, well, you come in, you take a test, we check your hormone levels, and then we see. But in that kind of state of mind, I was like, oh my God, I don't even know like how I'm supposed to feel about this. Because 24 hours ago, if I had started bleeding right now, I would have just assumed it was my period. And suddenly like my whole world has shifted and my frame of view has shifted. That was actually the moment when I was like, I don't know what's going on. And what I have to do is just embrace the uncertainty in this process. And so I remember talking to this entity, you know, who eventually became Hana, and said, I don't have any other framework for this except to say that I have I have been in relationships before where they have ended, and I try my best to make the endings as good as possible, that we just understand that our lives have to move on. So I said, let's walk this path together, and if we have to end it, that's okay. Like any other time, I have, you know, a social structure and a support structure that will help me through this. But until then, we're just going to walk this path. And that's just how I had to think about it, was almost like, we're sort of dating, we might break up. And if we break up, we'll try to make it as best of a breakup as possible.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there were three things that I really liked when you spoke with us at Feminist Camp that really stood out for me. I really enjoyed your description of the experience of giving birth.
Oh!
Primarily that was because I think that your approach to it was that of a scientist.
Yes. Yes. We can't remove that part.
So you were very thoughtful and considerate about what the experience was like.
Thank you. So I can describe that if that's helpful.
I think what it is more that, we, again, there seems to be certain narratives around it. And like the big thing is it hurts really bad, but I think that there was something about what you were saying about the quality of pain that was really valuable.
Yes. And you know, you definitely, when you are pregnant, you, one of the first things you will do will Google things like, how bad is the pain of delivery? Because, you know, you will say things like a bowling ball comes out between your legs and you're like, nope, not possible. Not possible. And, you know, I think that, you know, to understand also the depth and the complexity of different women's pains, you know, that pain can also vary because of a woman's individual tolerance of pain. Mm-hmm. There can also be pain because of past trauma or fears of body dysmorphia and that kind of stuff. And all of that, I think, contributes to the experience in that room. It's not just a thing that comes in a vacuum, that you absolutely bring everything of yourself to that experience too. But the one thing that I would say that at least for me was true was that it was a very different kind of pain than, like, you know, when I got my shoulder dislocated. That the pain of a shoulder dislocation is like your body is screaming, this is so wrong, it's not even funny. That the pain of ramping up the labor contractions, they actually feel like PMS contractions. And at first I was like, no, this isn't labor, this is PMS. And then you're like, oh, no, there is no MS. So, oh my God, it makes sense now. PMS is actually like labor contractions. So that's what it feels like at the beginning. It becomes more intense for sure. But as as a lot of women explained to me, it's not an intense pain. Again, like when you, when you injure a part of your body, it is like nonstop. It is unrelenting. Mm-hmm. Labor pains, they go through a contraction and then they release. And so it's this sinusoidal wave where you can almost go back to just feeling normal again. So the contraction will rise up almost like you're on a roller coaster and you're like, ah! And then it comes back down and you can breathe and it actually goes almost completely away. Then because I wasn't able to put, you know, I ran out of time and didn't have an epidural or any other kind of pain medicine. And, you know, that was kind of intense. I did feel, you know, all of the experience of the actual active labor, which is a much shorter period. So you can have these very, very intense contractions that grow for that 24 hours. Mine was really short, but I know that, you know, there can be a very long time that people have these. And then the actual intense labor is a little bit shorter. And that's the part that you're like, oh my God. But again, it comes and goes. And the pain is this very, very intense feeling. And then it sort of like subsides and it feels very much like a wave. But at the same time, there's also something very primal and fundamental that you feel like, this pain does not feel wrong. It's almost like your body and your brain and everything is stretching. The only way I can think about it is like if you're super, super, super out of shape and you start doing exercise and you're like, this sucks. It's really uncomfortable. And again, like the quality of the pain is totally different, but it's like, you know, that pain feels really different than if you actually sprained your ankle doing something else. And it's also a really powerful feeling. Like, I think it's like one of the first moments where you do not give a crap about what anyone else thinks or does. And you take that with you really forward. I remember that I had to move from the tub to the bed. And I remember when I told that story, someone else said, "Oh my God, you were like naked and wet and you must have been so cold." And of course, you know, there's like 12 people in the room. And I remember thinking, I didn't think about any of that stuff at the time. I didn't care about anything. I mean, the entire hospital could have seen me naked and waddling, and I would have been like, move.
This is happening now. I don't really care.
I don't really care. And like that part of it, when you think back later on it, is like incredibly empowering, because as a woman, you're like, everyone is judging you, right? And like asking you, you know, to do this or to that. And like for that one moment, no one can tell you anything that's going to matter at all to you, like at all.
Yeah. So post having a baby, what was your experience with that? Because that obviously is a huge learning curve for everyone. There is no handbook. I know that I have the sense, like when I see somebody with a baby, I always have this feeling like, oh, you're so much like more mature than me and older than me and stuff. But sometimes I'll look and I'll be like, that is a tiny baby. Like, you are learning. Mm-hmm. You're going through a crash course.
Well, I think also people do think that there's a handbook. So you do buy a lot of these books and they drive sales. And there's general structures of what things happen, and those are sort of helpful, but on a day-to-day or minute-to-minute level, they're different. I think that there's a big difference between the experience of pregnancy, which seems to be a continuous narrative to that having a child and then raising a newborn, but they're actually really, there's a very hard stop between being pregnant and then having a child. So being pregnant is like, you are yourself, your time is your own. And you're sort of waddling around with this thing, but there's nothing sort of making demands on you necessarily on a minute-to-minute level, especially if it's sort of a normal pregnancy. Which also, by the way, I don't like the term natural. It sets a lot of women up to feel like they failed if they did have a C-section or had an epidural or something like that. I was like, I don't know why you would call it natural. I didn't have it in a field with no medication. It was in a hospital with like two monitors on me and a staff of like 10. Mm-hmm. So what I did have was a pregnancy that did not require medical intervention. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's important to say, because I don't want to elevate my experience more than another woman's experience. And I also don't want any woman to feel like if they've had to do any of those other things or have chosen to do those, that it's a lesser experience. But once the baby comes out, you are now at the beck and call of a small thing that literally demands you, like, especially like every 2 hours. And it's not like you have weekends or evenings or anything off. It's right. Pretty relentless. So if you're somebody who's very used to kind of being your own boss and making time the way that you want to, it's a real shock to that system. So for me, I don't think I really, like, people could say, this is going to be a lot of hard work and you're not going to sleep very much. When you describe it in that way, both being an artist, teacher, entrepreneur, and all those things, like, it didn't scare me, right? Like, I knew how to work hard and I also knew how to work with very little sleep. That wasn't the issue. The actual fundamental struggle that I had was that suddenly of the 24 hours that, you know, at least 12 of those I felt were kind of mine, were suddenly not mine at all. That no matter what it is that I thought I wanted to do at any given time, there might be something else that I had to do instead, right? Whether it was change a diaper or feed or hold a crying baby or something like that. And it was kind of weird, because when people say it's hard, like, I knew, I was like, changing a diaper is not intellectually hard. Mm-hmm. So the hard part isn't the quality of the tasks. It's that you have to do things always when you don't necessarily want to or plan to. And that's a really, really, really different and very reactive way of living. And it's not like you get to sort of slowly ramp up to that. It's like you have the baby and wham, that's mm-hmm. your life now.
Yeah. You said when you were at Feminist Camp, I really loved when you said you're supposed to have a tribe. And you feel that when you have a baby.
Yes. So, you know, one of the things that I think really went against the narrative of like the nuclear family and, you know, all of these things of like, you know, you're supposed to figure this out on your own. I was like, no. Human beings would have never survived if their parents were that exhausted. Like, predator comes, you'd be like, sorry, take the whole family. We're exhausted. We're tired. You wouldn't ever do that, especially to a woman, right? Like, she just delivered a baby, lost a lot of blood. Her body's not in great shape. And you're like, now you're going to, like, make this person work in the fields or something? Like, no, that's not how this works. You protect each other. And so what I realized early on is that when someone would come in and help, it was like being myself with her was really, really, really difficult. Having my partner there made it easier, but it was still like we were both nonstop working and doing things. But having a third person made it like 100% better. And once you started like four people, it was like four adults and a baby. You're like, what's the big deal? Someone can sleep. Someone can eat. You can have adult conversation. Someone's still watching and caring for the baby, and someone's doing like the cooking or whatever else needs to be done. You basically are distributing that labor in a way that actually feels pretty natural, and it ties you together. Mm-hmm. You have to find a tribe. And whether it's your biological family or friends in a support structure, there is no heroism to doing it by yourself.
You talk about then the process of recognizing your new identity and problem solving for that, because you went through a point where you were like ready for things to go back to how they were before.
Yeah. So somewhere around 6 weeks to 8 weeks, I was pumping every 15 minutes. I was breastfeeding. You know, my partner has epilepsy. So I was doing all the nighttime taking. I was doing everything that I felt like I had to do. But I was also like, oh my God, like I did not get up to 45 years to have my life like this. And so I really questioned whether this was the right decision. And we contemplated adoption. And what I felt was that I needed to just really turn over every possibility to actually make sure that Hannah and I and my partner, like we were all making the decision that was best for everybody. The reactions of people around me, especially ones that were, I think, close friends, actually really shocked me. They yelled at me that they said I couldn't believe that I would be even thinking about this. Or somebody would say, oh, well, we'll adopt the kid. It was basically like this onslaught of either how could you or, oh, yeah, we'll take it. And what I really needed at that time was actually space to think about what was the real problems that I needed to solve, and was this the solution to that problem? And the answer ultimately was that adoption was not the solution. What I realized is the framework that I had of understanding how to fix a bad relationship, which was to end it, wasn't actually the answer at this point in time. What I actually really needed was a different way of thinking about time and my structure and expectations, and also to let go of this narrative that that I could sort of go back to the person that I was. Mm-hmm. And there's a grieving process. Like, you literally are saying goodbye to this other person, and you're like, I didn't know I had to say goodbye. Oh my God, would I have made the decision, you know, if I'd known this? And at the time, I don't know that that answer was yes, but that's what I had to do. So I think especially, you know, with the theme of this podcast, you look at the realities of what is there and you can't erase, right? Like, I think that's the really important lesson, is you can't erase things, that you take what you think are the mistakes and the stumbles. And it's like an artwork where any good art teacher will say, don't use your eraser, incorporate the things that are unexpected, that are mistakes, and make it part of the work.
That actually brings up one of the things that you said at Feminist Camp that I thought was so great, was talking about the relationship of a parent to a child and like thinking of Hannah as a medium.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I think of her, and I actually started thinking about this when I was teaching, was I really looked, and I was tutoring kids, so I was an artist and, you know, working with sculpture, and I thought of kids as like sculptures in time. Mm. Where you were like, we need to shave a little of this here, and we need to mold this and like let this grow into this a little bit more. And so I joked with people, but I was very serious that I felt like Hannah was a long-term art project. And people thought it was dismissive, and I was like, no. Like, if you are an artist, like, you're doing this because it's part of your calling. you're doing this not because of the ostensible sort of rewards that society thinks are important, but because it's fundamentally like something that you have to do in life and that it shapes your meaning. So calling something an art project is actually one of the most important things in your life. So, so the time that I wanted to spend with her was because I'm like, you need to understand the medium and the properties of this medium and what this thing can and wants to do. And I felt like as an artist, my job was to unlock those things and also to really let the medium flourish. And I didn't know what kind of medium it would be, but in that process of sort of playing with each other and practicing with each other and, you know, making little rough sketches and prototypes and everything, you're like, okay, I think I'm getting a little more understanding. But it really is like letting her tell me what properties she has.
That's great. I think that's really brilliant because of the expectations. I mean, you're talking about like the framework and expectations and narratives, right? Like the narrative that you should want to be a mother, or the narrative that once you have a baby and you're holding it in your hands, you must instinctively love it and you would never consider giving it up for adoption. Or the narrative that your child is going to grow to be the perfect doctor that you want them to be.
Right. Yeah, like all of these things, I mean, they're actually really beautiful and miraculous in kind of its messiness. And I think being an artist, like you embrace that a little bit more than others' identities in society allow you to practice that, right? There's this sense that by not knowing and not prescribing a path for someone, that you really, like, you're watching this thing blossom. And it's not like you're like, oh my God, I controlled every moment and this is the perfect creation I made. It's like you almost were like, I got out of its way just in time so that these petals could grow in this like amazing and unexpected way. And yeah. I think that's part of the thing that a lot of new parents, they're looking for advice on how to do things right. Or that if their child isn't hitting a particular milestone, that something must be wrong. And I think it sets a lot of parents up for a certain kind of fear that and worry that is absolutely not at all like it doesn't have to be part of the experience. Like you have to worry about them hurting themselves and them doing things like falling off of beds, but you don't have to worry about whether or not they're crawling today or in a month from now. Like in general, you know, unless there's something physically and developmentally wrong, they're going to figure it out on their own time. And I think that's the part of like looking at, you know, if you look at your child as a medium with all the unique properties that a medium has, they're going to figure out a way to get from point A to point B in their own kind of unique and individual ways. And, you know, baby advice books will always dismiss it and say, babies are all different, so don't worry about it. But here's kind of the general thing that all babies should be doing. And you're like, that's a mixed message here. You know, so there's a time when you can look very detail oriented at your own child and say, this is what my child is doing at this moment. And this is all that this child needs to be doing at this moment. I think I shared with the feminist boot camp the quote of Alexander Herzen's that says, you know, just paraphrasing, you know, because children grow up, we think that that's the purpose of children is to grow up. But the purpose of a child is to be a child and to really think of the now, because later is too late. And there's, you know, there's so many things in society that makes you think about planning for the future and all these other kind of things when you know that what you can only do is make the best decision for now. So I think that applies very much to raising a child. And for all the dreams and hopes and wishes, I can go back to like my own parents. And I realize the one thing that you just really want for your child is you want this child in this particular world to be happy.
Yeah. Fantastic.
And whatever that takes is like, that's what you're going to do.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Well, this was, hopefully there's something useful there. And I look forward to hearing that in other future podcasts.
Susie Lee is a multi-talented polymath with a background in science, tech, and education, although she primarily identifies and works as an artist these days. You can learn more about her work in the world through her website, SusieJLee.com. To learn more about my work in the world, visit CaitlinSCHatch.com. www.everythingisworkable.com. Along with more episodes of Everything is Workable, you can find my blog, books, and art. You can also become a patron or leave a tip to help support the things that I do. This episode of Everything is Workable was made possible through the patronage of Gretchen Wagner, Julian and Shannon Hatch, Winita Budgen, and Margaret Prescott, among others. Thank you to Tejai Moore of More Music for the original theme song.